On November 9th through the 11th, the Federal Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
I mean, with all that applause, I think we're done, right? We're not going to improve on that. It's good to be among friends again. I'm Ken Marcus. I chair the Civil Rights Practice Group. I've seen some of you before. How many of you have been to Civil Rights Practice Group events before? Nice. How many of you are new? So I'm calculating I can use about 50% of the same material from last year. I'm going to tell you the other 50% got me into a little bit of trouble, so I'm going to try to avoid that if I can.
What was it?
Well, that's the part I can't.
You're asking for trouble.
Listen to the prosecutor over here. I mean, last year I gave a little talk at the beginning, and then I got a call from a national reporter. And she said to me, I listened to your remarks, and I heard about what you're doing with the Civil Rights Practice Group, and I just can't believe that you have managed to accomplish so little. Now, reflexively, I like to agree with people, so I said, yes, yes, I think so too. And then I said, wait a minute. Wait, could we talk about this? So she said, you know, you talked about how you have these great panels at the convention and at other events throughout the year. You talked about the webinars that you do throughout the year, the court step events after Supreme Court and other decisions come down. You talked about the blog entries and the other publications that your members put together. But I know that what you're really supposed to be doing and what you're really actually doing is you are dominating the federal judiciary and the attorneys general throughout the United States. And I said to her, that's not the Federalists, that's the Zionists. I said, you've got to come to me at my office and see me at my day job. You can play with the space lasers, we can make some weather together. Happy to go over it with you. She said, no. She said, this has all been reported before. She says, I know. You have an executive committee. We do. And you've got very prominent people from academia, former officials of the federal government. You've got people who are prominent in public interest organizations. And you set the agenda for the United States. And I said, again, that's the Zionists. And I'm not sure if I can break it down for you, but Federalists and Zionists, I said, you know, one of them is this kind of odd, quasi-religious, political sect that's despised throughout the world. And the other is the liberation movement of the Jews. I don't know why that interview did not go over well. But it's really important that we not repeat a similar problem today. So I don't know whether Gene and Dean and Nate are in the room and the leadership they provided to us. I think if they are, they're probably saying, my God, Marcus has one job, introduce the judge. And people still don't know who the judge is, and you're still going on and on. I want to thank them. I also want to thank Sam Fendler. I told Gene Meyer recently, I said, I am willing to continue to take all of the credit as long as Sam is willing to do all of the work. So I thank Sam Fendler for his work in putting this together, as well as the executive committee. And I thank Judge Stephen Vaden. And so I'm going to say a few things about him to begin with the boilerplate. Judge Vaden, if you don't know, is a judge on the United States Court of International Trade. Before joining the court in 2020, he served as general counsel of the United States Department of Agriculture for 4 years. He began his career in the private sector, where he worked for Jones Day and Patton Boggs. I have had the privilege of hearing him speak before, and I have to say we are deeply honored to have him moderating, and we should very generously welcome Judge Vadim.
Well, thank you all so much, and it's wonderful to be here this afternoon. I would be remiss if I didn't take a moment to note what today is. It is our observance of Veterans Day. Of course, Veterans Day is actually tomorrow, commemorating on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, when the guns of World War I fell silent. We have unfortunately all been reminded how important it still is in the 21st century that men and women are willing to take up arms to defend freedom by events overseas. So I'd like to acknowledge each and every person in this room who has served in the armed forces of the United States and allowed us to have this discussion here today. So with that, we're going to have a very healthy discussion about a very pertinent and timely issue in the best tradition of the Federalist Society. I'm going to provide a little introduction, then I'm going to tell you who you're going to hear from and the order that you'll hear from them, then I'll get out of the way and let them talk. The Supreme Court of the United States has held that no state has any authority under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to use race as a factor in affording educational opportunities among its citizens. After that holding, there was much consternation around the educational community. There were efforts made to decide how they could undercut it, perhaps circumvent it, and that necessitated the very next year the Supreme Court in the second Brown versus Board of Education case to declare that their ruling should be implemented with, quote, all deliberate speed. In 2023, the Supreme Court once again took up the issue of the role of race in choosing who may attend certain educational institutions. And in that case, the Supreme Court declared, and I quote, "Eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it," close quote. It was not a straight line between Brown versus Board of Education and Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard University. There were many cases that came in between, most notably the 1978 Bakke decision involving the University of California. That decision grievously split the Supreme Court 4-4, with Justice Powell's decision being the one that ultimately came to be controlling, where Justice Powell found that educational freedom, the right of academic freedom that academic institutions have, allow them to select their own student body. That rationale came to be known as the diversity rationale and was later adopted by a majority of the Supreme Court in 2003 in the Grutter v. Bollinger decision. However, even in that decision, there was consternation among the court and even among some members of the majority, where the opinion seemed to come with a sunset clause that limited it to perhaps 25 years and contained the following quote, "All race-conscious admission programs must have a termination point," close quote. The question we're here to address is, did that termination point come this year, or did it not? At the conclusion of his majority opinion, Justice Roberts seemed to leave the door open. That's beyond the issue of footnote 4, which expressly exempted military academies from the holding of Students for Fair Admission. But Justice Roberts, responding to the multiple dissents at the end of his opinion, noted in passing that, of course, students who are writing essays are free to talk about whatever they want to, including race, and that colleges may, of course, take this into account. This has been the subject of much discussion since. Some of you may have attended yesterday's panel that was put on by the in-house counsel group that dealt with another part of the Students for Fair Admission. I want to tell you there are going to be two main differences between yesterday's panel and today's panel. First, we're not going to bore you. And if you attended yesterday's panel, you know what I'm talking about. Second, we're going to be focused on the context of the Students for Fair Admission case itself. That is the academic context and what it means. Of course, our panelists can talk about it in the private sector context as well, but we're going to be particularly interested in the context of higher education. With that, I will introduce our speakers. Immediately to my left is Professor Gail Harriet, who teaches and writes in the area of civil rights, employment, discrimination, product liability remedies, and torts. She is a professor at the University of San Diego Law School, and she's currently a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. To her left is Akil Amar, who really needs no introduction because he is such a great friend of the Federalist Society and always a debater in good spirit. But I know he would want me to tell you all about his latest book, The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840. I believe he was signing copies of it earlier today, and if you happen to miss him, I bet he'd sign a copy for you. Further to his left, but only in geographical location, is Devin Westhill. Devin is an attorney also focused on matters of constitutional and civil rights. Devin and I know each other. You used to work at the Federalist Society as one of the officers, but in addition to that, Devin and I served together at the United States Department of Agriculture, where he ably served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights. Currently, Devin leads the Center for Equal Opportunity and is a frequently quoted speaker in the press and files amicus briefs in courts on these issues. And last, but certainly not least, is Professor Randall Kennedy of the Harvard Law School. Professor Kennedy teaches courses on contracts, criminal law, and the regulation of race relations. He is also a former clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall of the United States Supreme Court. And so with that, I will turn it over to Professor Harriet.
You're making me nervous, Judge. Now I feel like I can't bore them to death. So I'll try here, you know. My friends sometimes call me a pessimist. But if you're concerned that my talk is going to be a downer in which I list all the ways that universities will circumvent the Supreme Court's decision, you can relax. I'm pretty happy about this decision. We haven't won the war, and things could still go awry, but provided that win is defined realistically, the whole thing seems a lot more winnable now than it did before. Yes, universities will attempt to get around the court's decision, but we don't need 100% compliance for positive things to start to come from the court's decision. So here are my predictions, and I suspect they won't be all that different from a lot of your predictions. Some schools are going to experiment with doing away with standardized tests, but those that hope to be viewed as academically rigorous, they won't like the results, and I think a lot of them will reverse course. MIT's already done so after abandoning the SAT during the COVID-19 lockdown. Some schools are going to be experimenting more with class preferences. They will find that there are a lot more low-income Asian Americans and whites than they thought, and they will also find that their African American and Latino applicants are not all low income by any means. If they try to get around that problem by defining social class in a way that advantages one racial group over another, they will risk being the target of the next wave of lawsuits, which is already being planned. And some will give preferences to those who purport to have overcome obstacles, as Chief Justice Roberts' opinion runs, and they're going to find that there are a lot of obstacles out there in the world, not just race. And again, they're going to find that it's more complicated than they thought. So realistically, universities that want to avoid litigation are going to have to start shrinking the academic credentials gap. And by academic credentials gap, I mean the difference at each institution between the entering academic credentials of students of each race. So currently, as a direct result of racial preferences, that gap is very, very large on most selective campuses. Even a small reduction of those gaps is going to help out. So the most immediate effect, The most immediate effect of that, when it happens, will be better grades as more minority students attend schools where they are academically competitive. Alas, the facts are very clear here. No serious advocate of race preferences denies that currently the credentials gap results in disappointing grades for preference beneficiaries. To be sure, some students outperform their entering credentials, just as some students underperform their entering credentials. But most students perform in the general range that their entering academic credentials suggest. Back in 2005, law professors Ian Ayers and Richard Brooks, both advocates of race preferences, candidly agreed that the disappointing grades problem is, and I'm quoting here, real and serious, and that the average black law student's grades are startlingly low. Ivy League presidents William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, who were among the most lionized defenders of preferences, also admitted to the problem. College grades present, and again I'm quoting here, a sobering picture. The grades earned by African American students often reflect their struggles to succeed academically in highly competitive academic settings. You know, that's a quotation from theirs. Over the decades, this has had a real effect. Nobody feels comfortable when they can see that minority students are disproportionately struggling. So minority students themselves often wonder whether the standards they are being held to are fair. Under the circumstances, it's tempting for students to wonder, is the professor really a racist? Instructors nervously paper over the problem with grade inflation, but they haven't been able to make it go away. Once universities begin complying with the Supreme Court's decision, the problem will begin to be ameliorated as more African American and Latino students attend schools where their entering academic credentials make them academically competitive. They will earn better grades, more will be earning honors, and that can change campus culture, and I believe it will change it for the better. Slowly, to be sure, but it will change it. For example, the incentives of universities to allow runaway grade inflation should fade as low grades correlate less and less with race and ethnicity. It may be too late on that, but you know, should get something. More important, for years now, critical race theorists have been arguing that academic standards are often just a sham, an expression of white supremacy. And struggling minority students have sometimes had an incentive, you know, to believe it. As minority students are doing better and better, that message is going to ring false to them. Another example, the tendency of many minority students on many campuses to believe they have more in common with students of their own race than they do with students with, say, their own major, you know, that should start receding as well. The self-segregation problem, insisting that universities provide separate student lounges, separate student dorms, graduation ceremonies, all based on race, that should recede. So the question then is, am I being a Pollyanna for believing this can happen? And the answer is, I've already seen it done. On the University of California campuses, right after Prop 209 passed in 1996, that was the ban on race preferences that went into effect in 1998, GPAs dramatically changed in just a year. Yes, there were fewer underrepresented minority students at the flagship Berkeley campus. But on several other UC campuses, all of which are elite, the numbers actually increased. And it's the college GPAs that you got to keep your eye on. They are the key. Just prior to Prop 209's implementation, UC San Diego, there was only one African American freshman student out of a class of over 3,000 who earned an honors level GPA of 3.5 or better. By contrast, 20% of white students had done so. Immediately after Proposition 209 went into effect, the rate at which African American freshmen earned honors shot up to, you can guess, 20%, absolutely. Moreover, the number of African-American students whose GPA put them in academic jeopardy collapsed, went from 15% down to 6%. Boom. That was exactly what we were expecting and exactly what we got. If universities are less compliant with the law this time around, the effect may be less dramatic, but there will be benefits. The effect on careers is likely to be positive too. Having the opportunity to attend an elite university is obviously a good thing, but the weight of the evidence indicates that doing well in school is more important for a student wishing to enter a high-status career. Put differently, race preferential admissions hurt rather than help the intended beneficiary's career prospects. If the research into mismatch is correct, and I believe it is, we would have more African-American scientists, engineers, and physicians, and likely more African-American lawyers and college professors if more African-American students had rejected the preferential treatment they received. That's a thumping good reason to reject racial preferences. Fortunately, we don't need universities to go cold turkey on racial preferences in order to put a dent in mismatch. Even minimal compliance is likely to help here. But here comes the caveat, ladies and gentlemen. If those who oppose race preferences just sit back and hope the Supreme Court's opinion will do the magic, the gains may be ephemeral. The typical university these days employs armies of individuals who view it as their job to thwart the court's decision. That has to be dealt with. So start with this. Governors need to appoint state university trustees who will ensure that the law is obeyed. It's already happening in Florida. Higher ed is too important to leave these boards to political donors who just want free box tickets at the football game. We need serious trustees, and they need their own independent staff. Similarly, state legislators should follow the example of Texas. Cut funding to diversity, equity, and inclusion apparatus on state campuses. It only helps support race preferential admissions. The amount of money that's involved is truly staggering. Turn off the spigot. Careful thought also needs to be given to how to reduce the incentives that push universities towards greater racial preferences. A good example is the Hispanic Serving Institutions program, or the HSI program, which heaps federal monies on schools with student bodies that are at least 25% Hispanic. Unlike the Historically Black Colleges and Universities program, eligibility for which is based on history, the HSI program creates an incentive for schools to discriminate in order to meet that 25% threshold. The program is almost certainly unconstitutional and should be eliminated. Do I have other ideas? Yes, I do, like reining in accreditors who pressure universities into discriminating. But I think I've run out of time, haven't I, Judge? Okay. Then I'm out of here, guys.
You can stay seated or stand, whichever you like.
I'm given an option to stay seated or stand. I think it was Satchel Paige who said, never stand when you can sit down, you know, never sit down when you can lie down. So he also said, don't look back, something might be gaining on you. So I think I'll sit. It's always an honor to be with you all. And thank you, Judge, for that kind shout out to the book. I'm going to give myself a shout out to a podcast. It's free. It's weekly, and there are several episodes about the Students for Fair Admissions case that might be of interest to you. We had a few. We have 150 episodes all in all. I say we. This is my partner, Dr. Andrew Lipka, and I. We have people on the right and on the left as guests. We had the great Will Bode, and from whom some of you will be hearing very shortly, and the great Michael Paulson talking about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We've had Ed Whalen on, lots of other folks. But we had some episodes during the oral argument of the Students for Fair Admissions case, and we played clips from almost all the justices, so you heard their voices and their positions. And then afterward, we had at least two episodes with the former dean of admission of Yale College, Jeffrey Brenzel, talking about how he thought various schools would react to the ruling, so those might be of interest to you, and it's free. If you just Google Akhila Maher podcast, you can find it. It's got the cute title, America's Constitution. So I think I have five quick points here. First, affirmative action discourse in America, frankly, has been pretty deeply dishonest in all sorts of ways, because there are uncomfortable truths that people sometimes tiptoe around. Gail mentioned some. I suspect my friend Randy will mention others. But since you mentioned the Rick Sanders mismatch thesis, there has been a mismatch between what some sincere and principled believers in affirmative action actually think and what they say. What they actually think is that affirmative action is best justified as a remedy for America's historical wrongs going all the way back to 1619, but that we the happier talk of diversity rather than the talk of remedy, because remedy requires awkward discussions about our history, maybe finger pointing. If you have a remedy, and the reason we talk the happy talk of diversity, oh, it's good and we should have more of it, and we should in theory have more of it forever and for every category, is that beginning with Justice Powell's swing opinion in the Bakke case, it was a 4-1-4, and then with Grutter and Gratz and Fisher, the diversity rationale was really the only one that the Supreme Court would allow advocates of affirmative action, racial preferences of a certain sort, to put forth. What this has meant in part, if we're being very candid, is a less singular focus on blacks and Native Americans in America, because I think they would have the strongest argument on remedial grounds, given slavery and segregation and dispossession of Native Americans. So less focus unique focus on them. Hispanics have been the beneficiary to some extent of the diversity theory. Asian Americans to some extent have been the victims of this. There's been displacement in various schools, taking seats away from Asian Americans who might be statistically overrepresented, as Jews were in a previous generation since we heard about Zionism. And these are some of the things that I think you can expect to see going forward. Is some, maybe we'll have a more candid conversation about history, and maybe we'll hear about some of that from my friend Randy, although I don't want to put words in his mouth. On second point, on Hispanics versus Asians, and the facts, especially of the Harvard case. Even if you believe in affirmative action, you should not. So one thing that Harvard did is took some spots that might on the numbers, the academic numbers, have gone to Asians and basically given them to Hispanics. So because God forbid the white number should ever go down. All the non-whites kind of look alike from a certain point of view. And this is some of the dishonesty you see of our recent discourse. But above and beyond that, I think the numbers showed that Harvard was affirmatively discriminating against Asian Americans. Not that they weren't the beneficiaries of affirmative action, but that they were actually, it was harder to get into Harvard when you looked at the academic credentials as an Asian American than it was as a white. That's not really affirmative action. Especially if one is attentive to history, that's just discriminating against a group that actually pretty came late to the American experience in general. And the lower courts either were statistically illiterate, or didn't really want to question the great Harvard University. Because our elite institutions have to be, right, didn't want to take seriously the limits on affirmative action that were enunciated by Powell's opinion in Bakke, and then Grutter and Gratz and Fisher, how it's not supposed to be a quota. They were, the lower court, in my view, was kind of underruling, as it were, Grutter and Gratz and Fisher, the way some of the lower courts are claimed to have been underruling City of Chicago versus McDonald in the Second Amendment case. A Second Amendment context, leading to pushback in a case like Bruin, and you saw similar pushback in Students for Fair Admission because the lower courts really weren't taking seriously the idea that maybe you could have a plus, but it can't be a quota. And there was an interesting dynamic between the Supreme Court and lower federal courts that was going on. Third point. Even if you think that the government should have nothing whatsoever to do with categorizing or classifying people according to race, this divvying us up on racial grounds is a sordid business. Even if you are the fiercest of colorblindness advocates, you might think that we have constitutional rules against the government, but those rules shouldn't automatically be applied against every private institution in America. Government can't have a religion, but Akhil gets to have one. Government shouldn't have a gender preference, sexual orientation preference, but Akhil gets to. And you might think that it was a mistake to bring together the rules for private schools, even those that get government funding, and the rules for the government. You might think that no private school that calls itself a charity and does get tax preference in certain ways, the tax deductibility of a charitable contribution, you might think that even a private school should not be discriminating against historically underrepresented groups, that not everything counts as a proper school. You know, it's got to teach certain things, reading, writing, arithmetic, and it should act in charitable ways. And you might think a private school for whites only isn't really a proper charity, the same way you might think that, you know, Fagan's School for Thieves, they'll teach you how to pick a pocket or two, isn't really the kind of school that we should be treating as a proper charity. But even if you think that, is a private school that gets charitable tax treatment, why shouldn't some private schools be allowed to vote their resources, their brand, to the mitigation or the elimination of some of the historic underrepresentations in America that have been the product of all sorts of bad acts, many illegal, perhaps some technically legal, some by government, some by private persons. So should private institutions, should we change current civil rights laws to allow private institutions to engage in race-conscious, preferential admissions and scholarships and other things that public institutions should not be allowed to do for reasons having to do with an idea that our government should be strictly impartial and colorblind? That's an interesting question going forward. It might bring together some folks on the right who believe in private choice and some folks on the left. Fourth point. There are some areas of law that even though we're moving away from a quotified, bottom line, disparate effect idea, are still going to have residues of quota and disparate effect analysis. I think the two especially are jury service and voting, certain political rights. In Batson context and elsewhere, where we're going to be especially suspicious just of bottom line disproportionality. And I think there are two reasons for this. There's a podcast episode on this particular issue if you're interested, having to do with, I'll call it the denominator problem and the aggregation issue, or the winner-take-all issue. For certain political rights, let's take voting. Whether your vote counts or not, formally everyone votes, but it matters to you whether, in effect, you get to vote for a winner or whether you're voting for a loser, whether your vote is, as it were, a wasted vote. The power of your vote is going to be dependent in part on the voters around you, and that's going to require, and this is, of course, our voting rights laws, focus more on bottom line effects, especially whether it's racially polarized voting, than in other domains. There's an article in the Stanford Law Review. It's called The Hybrid Nature of Political Rights. It's by Professor Vikram Amar and Alan Brownstein, and it elaborates this. The denominator problem is somewhat similar. There are all sorts of areas where you just might not think that everything, even in a perfectly just world, is randomly distributed. It might be that more women are interested in teaching women's studies or English lit. That was a very gendered example, but it might be that in other domains you're going to get a disproportionately high percentage of Asians or Jews or Italian Americans or whatever. It might be that even in a perfectly just world, for reasons, all sorts of reasons, culture and otherwise, people of Kenyan ancestry might be disproportionately represented among the winners of marathons. We don't know, you know, why that might be so. Lots of reasons having to do with culture, but you don't think, we shouldn't probably think that when it comes to voting and jury service. We should think probably if there's a world in which there hasn't been improper discrimination, we should be getting proportional representation on juries and among voters. So don't be surprised if courts continue to have more of a bottom line disparate impact analysis when it comes to jury service and voting. Finally, and my friend Gail mentioned this briefly, if we're really serious about the diversity rationale, even if it's not permissible in certain contexts, if we're really serious about the full remedial rationale, our great institutions, public and private, need to do a better job, forget admissions, about integrating people from different backgrounds once they get on to campus, in their residential housing, in their dining choices, in their extracurriculars and clubs, and more generally. And I think in their choices of majors and academic programs, and we need to do a much, much better job of that. And that's what some of us who believed in diversity and remedy have always actually put forth as the ideal, and we're not doing it. So those are my five thoughts. Thank you very much.
So good afternoon. I was told I have 5 to 8 minutes to make my remarks. I'm going to try to stick to that. But I have to say, to start things off, as a person who joined the Federalist Society as a student member on day one of law school, it is an incredible honor to be addressing this group, this convention. I've even worked to organize some of these things. I'm a big fan of the Federalist Society. It's just an amazing honor. When I got the invitation to speak on this panel, I said, yes, wow, what an amazing thing. And then I got a response from the Federalist Society staff saying, oh, that's great, we're so happy to have you. You're also going to be on with Professor Harriet Amar and Kennedy. So obviously, I tried to think of a polite way to get out of this. Obviously, I'm not smart enough to do that. So here I am. But that made me wonder, so why me, right? I can't give you sort of the academic perspective on SFFA and beyond, or the scholarly perspective. You're getting that in spades on this panel here. I don't really even consider myself an expert on much of anything. I just consider myself a simple country lawyer. you know, I went to public schools. And whatnot. But one of the reasons why I think I might have been chosen for this panel or to be invited for this panel is one of the reasons why I joined the Federalist Society some years ago on the first day of law school, and that is because the Federalist Society appreciates diversity. And what I mean by that is diversity of perspective. And I think I bring perhaps some of that here. I don't want to prejudge my co-panelists, but you know, I'm just a poor black kid from the South. I was raised by a single mother. All three of, you know, my two siblings and I were raised by a single mother and poor. You know, we were homeless at periods of time. We worked our way up from there to housing projects, from housing projects to Section 8 apartments, and then eventually by the time I was a teenager, we had our own house in the ghetto. That was great. You know, it was our own house. It was the best thing we'd ever had, and we really appreciated that. But I've never known my father. He's been in prison pretty much as long as I can remember. To this day, I think he is in prison. Given the rough upbringing that we went through and the statistics that suggest that children who come up that way end up sort of in this terrible doom loop, that's what happened to my brother. My brother went to prison just as soon as he was old enough. My sister was a teen mom, and I, you know, neither one of them graduated from high school, and I went sort of a different path. I say this only because, in part, the horse is sort of out of the stable to some extent. I've already announced this to other people, sort of my background, but also I think it's because I'm not the type of person you expect to say, I think the Supreme Court did the right thing in effectively outlawing race preferences in college admissions. But here I am saying that. I think from a legal standpoint, from a policy standpoint, and also from a moral standpoint, it's the right thing to do. From the policy standpoint, I think for many of the reasons that have already been articulated, and I'm not going to go through here, but maybe we will get into in the Q&A, I think on the whole, affirmative action has been a problem for the individuals who are supposed to be the intended beneficiaries of it. The organization that I run, the Center for Equal Opportunity, has produced over 80 studies documenting and looking at the effect of affirmative action at certain colleges and universities around the country, law schools as well, medical schools. And our most recent one was a study of the University of Maryland. This was before the June decision, the entering class of 2021. We're looking at that data. What we saw was that black students, it wasn't a surprise, were about three times as likely to be admitted to the University of Maryland College Park than white students. But this didn't do them any favors. Based on the data that we analyzed, we saw that black students had the lowest six-year graduation rate of any race or ethnicity at the University of Maryland in that time period as well. So again, I'm not gonna go into great detail about the mismatch theory and so forth. We can talk about that, but really just dust off your books on that and take a look at it. I think that's something that should not be forgotten in this whole conversation. It really obscures, in my view, what affirmative action was meant to do. On the heels of the 1960s civil rights movement and successes, and how it got perverted over time. This is SFFA, but also beyond. Let me just really quickly say, maybe I'm a little bit more optimistic than Gail, or maybe more pessimistic than Gail. So I'm going to agree that, look, I think at the end of the day, although I can nitpick the decision from June, the era of overt racial preferences, I think, is over. I'm happy to see institutions like the University of North Carolina, where I have one of my degrees, really pivoting hard away from what it did for a long period of time, put a lot of money into, which is to treat people differently based on their skin color, based on where their ancestors are from. We've seen also other institutions banning the box, right, getting rid of the checkbox to ask students sort of what their race is. This is all really positive stuff. Law firms now are being sued successfully. They're sort of just rolling over when they get sued for their diversity fellowships that, again, treat people differently based on their race. And the service academies, I think, I've heard someone else use this terminology, I think it's right, are now being sued. They didn't really, in my view, in footnote 4 in the decision, get a carve out, but more of a day pass. And that day pass is going to come due very soon. I am pessimistic, though. What I've seen much more of is an attempt to evade the decision. The Biden administration, for example, I think, really, you know, did a terrible thing in putting out guidance to schools. Instead of saying, hey, look, the Supreme Court has said something really important here about equality under the law and about treating people in this country equally. We really need you to comply. Well, you know, here are some ways in which you can get around this. I thought that was the wrong way to go about things. And to this room, I say, look, a wise man once said, elections have consequences. It really does matter who runs the Justice Department, the Civil Rights Division, OCR at the Education Department, if the Education Department will still exist in another administration. These things really do matter as a result of that, and we're seeing why. But we're seeing schools change their essay prompts, for example. We saw Columbia, for example, asking for students to submit 90-second videos of themselves, which really just seemed like an on-the-nose kind of way to figure out what their skin color was and whether it was something they were interested in their admittees. But there's a continuum of sort of bad ideas and how schools might change their admissions practices that I think we ought to be testing in the courts and we should be taking a look at. It's one of the reasons why my organization just today made an announcement that we are launching the After Affirmative Action Network, which will be a bit of a clearinghouse to gather information about what's going on around the country at these selective institutions after the decision. And then to give that information to lawyers who are interested in this type of thing, to journalists and others, so that we're doing two different things. One, we're ensuring compliance with the new state of the law. We're really testing the boundaries to see how far the court will allow affirmative action, you know, to go after the June decisions, but then also to share best practices. Again, UNC and other schools are doing some things to change their practices, which may very well be the type of thing that we want other schools to be doing going forward. And so if you're interested in that type of thing, get with me. I would like to hear from you. Finally, there is a case right now on petition for certiorari, the TJ case. I'm just assuming that most of the audience knows about this case of high school in Virginia that basically changed its admissions practices that did not include any sort of racial element in selecting its applicants, but very clearly had the purpose of racially gerrymandering its classes. The Pacific Legal Foundation is representing the plaintiffs in that case. And I'm hopeful that the court will take that case and really expound on its position that eliminating racial discrimination means eliminating all of it. In my view, that's racial discrimination. And if the core purpose of the 14th Amendment is to eliminate all governmental distinctions based on race, it has to extend to that sort of behavior, and that won't be acceptable after SFFA. The Center for Equal Opportunity filed an amicus brief in that case documenting the extent to which the Fairfax County School Board has been tinkering with race in this way for a long period of time. And again, we think that is, after SFFA especially, illegal and the sort of conduct that we can't tolerate going forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all who have played a role in organizing this event and inviting me to be part of it. I'd especially like to thank Sam Fendler, who shows exemplary efficiency and courtesy and has been very welcoming. I have two points I'd like to make. One goes a bit outside of our specific topic. The first point I want to make has to do with the trajectory of race relations over the last 70 years. So the judge began with bringing our attention back to May 17th, 1954, the day the Supreme Court announced Brown versus Board of Education. 1954 has a special ring for me because I was born in 1954, September 10th, 1954. And indeed, I was born in Columbia, South Carolina. So, in South Carolina, the year that I was born, in January of 1954 in South Carolina, the Constitution of South Carolina decreed that white people would go to one school and colored people would go to another. That was part of its constitutional law. It had statutes that effectuated that, but that was so important in South Carolina, it was part of its constitutional regime. I want us to think about change in American life since 1954. There's been a lot of talk on our front pages of newspapers with people talking about and debating about and arguing about whether there has been change in the United States of America with respect to race relations. Clearly, there has been change in the United States of America with respect to race relations. And wherever you stand on the ideological spectrum, yes, I am on the left. I am on the left. Wherever you stand with respect to the ideological spectrum, there has been, thank God, change, considerable change in the United States of America. Part of that change is the affirmative action story. Now, different people have different views with respect to affirmative action and its effectiveness, and I'm going to turn to that in a minute. But affirmative action is part of the progress that America has seen over the past 70 years. And the affirmative action ethos has been part of virtually all aspects of decent American life. Even the people who say they're against affirmative action are affected by the affirmative action ethos. Even the Federalist Society, there's no question but that the, you know, the center of gravity with the Federalist Society is against affirmative action. Is the Federalist Society not attentive to race consciousness? My colleague here talked about why is he part of this program. I have no doubt that at least part of the reason I am part of this program has to do with my race. I say that, I'm not putting down the Federalist Society. I don't think that's the only thing. I hope that my record, you know, gives me standing to take up some of your time. I've written, I've spoken. I hope that people, whether they agree with me or not, think that I have something useful to say. But I don't think that's all of it. I think that there has been, and amongst the authorities in this institution, a decent feeling of, well, gosh, we're putting together a program, do we want to make an effort to bring in different people? Ideological difference? Yes. Racial difference? Yes. Is there a part? There are many conservatives who, in making employment decisions, other sorts of decisions, ask themselves, can I do something? Can I do my part in assisting the country to remedy its history, its terrible history of racial oppression? The answer to that is yes. Judges, some of whom are on record as being against affirmative action, do they make a special effort to go to law schools, to go to student societies in an effort to bring in racial minorities? The answer is yes, they do. That's race conscious. In my view, it's good. Second point, we've been talking about the Supreme Court's decision. A number of speakers have said they thought it was a good decision. I don't. I think it was a bad decision. Number one, let's get clear what the Supreme Court of the United States said. The Supreme Court of the United States, in its decision, outlawed racial affirmative action. That's right. And in doing so, they took it off the table. It is no longer a matter of regular politics. I think that my colleague, Professor Harriet, had some, and in her writings, and in the writings of other critics of affirmative action, I think they make some very strong points. I think they make some very strong points. And I think that these points should be subject to debate. I think that people should be able to listen to the debaters, and at the end of the debate, maybe come to the conclusion, no, we don't want affirmative action. Just like 9 states outlawed affirmative action prior to the Supreme Court's decision, like California did. Seems to me that should be a matter of regular politics. What happened to judicial restraint? Conservatives. What happened to Thayerism in the idea of, you know, the way the Supreme Court ought to deploy its power? What happened to the idea of experimentation? Some institutions have it, affirmative action, some don't. We can see, you know, let people decide. Let's let a record erupt. Let people vote with their feet. What about ideas of localism as opposed to the imposition from on high of one national standard? What about that? Now, one response to me might very well be, well, yeah, Kennedy, that's fine, but we're talking about invidious racial discrimination. I don't think we're talking about invidious racial discrimination. I do not think that Harvard University was discriminating against white people or people of Asian American ancestry. Was Harvard University and the University of North Carolina and other institutions in their admissions policies, was their admission policy disadvantaging white candidates, Asian American candidates? Answer, yes. I mean, if you have 100 seats and you are giving a boost to, let's say, the black applicants and Latino applicants, is that disadvantaging people who are not black, not Latino? Yes. Yes, it's disadvantaging them. Is it discriminating against them? That's where I'd say no. It's disadvantaging them. Oh, I heard the laugh. I heard the laugh. Okay, I'm willing to go with the laugh. Yes, there's a distinction in my mind. There's a distinction in my mind between the government, or not just the government, because we're talking about, you know, Harvard's a private institution. There's a distinction between disadvantaging and discriminating against. I think there's a difference between a racial distinction, a racial discrimination, and an invidious racial discrimination. We can push that. We can talk about that more later, but just as an opening gambit, that is my position. Now, I want to end by taking up where my colleague left off with the issue of racial neutrality. It'll be very interesting to see how the courts handle the issue of racial neutrality. So, for instance, you know, there's some institutions, well, Texas. Texas is top 10% plan. If you're in the top 10% of your class, no matter what your class is in Texas, you get your ticket to the University of Texas. Clearly, clearly part of that was race conscious. The numbers had gone down for Latinos and blacks in the aftermath of the outlawing of racial affirmative action, and this was viewed as politically intolerable. And so Texas authorities figured out some, you know, the Texas 10% plan. In other places, we will see other workarounds. Question, what will the courts do about that? My colleague thinks that the courts will comprehensively outlaw that. I don't think so. We'll see, time will tell. I think rather what we'll see is the courts compromise. I think that they will muddle through. I think that with devices that are sufficiently ambiguous, the courts will let them go. If you are too obvious in your workaround, I think the courts will strike it, those selection schemes down. But I don't think that the court is going to be comprehensive and thoroughgoing in its effort to erase all race lines in American life, including race lines in American life that are clearly aimed at continuing the work of redressing our historical past. I don't think they're going to be willing to do that. And again, I don't think they're going to be willing to do that because they're going to understand that the affirmative action ethos is part of the progress that America has made over the past 70 years. Thank you all very much.
Well, I promised you all we weren't going to bore you, so mission accomplished. I just want to ask one question of the panel that I was thinking about when all of you spoke, and then we're going to turn it over to our audience members for their questions. But in particular, Professor Kennedy, I want to pick up something that you drew on, namely the suggestion that this should be subject to experimentation and let different people try different things and see what the results are and see what we like better and adjust accordingly. We are 45 years from Bakke. We are 20 years from Grutter. At a bare minimum, I think 20 years is an opportunity to take a look at what we've got and see whether or not some things have succeeded and some things have not. My own personal opinion, I think that college campuses now, to most American citizens, are symbols of intolerance rather than tolerance when it comes to dissenting viewpoints. I also note that you mentioned 1953, 54, 55, and the Brown decisions. Taking that, there's another difference that I can think of between what we might have expected in the United States of the 1950s and what we are seeing in 2023. And that is that the explosion post-Hamas invasion of Israel in anti-Semitism is not taking place in Philadelphia, Mississippi. It is taking place in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and on the campus of multiple Ivy League and other respected universities nationwide. So I'm wondering, given what we are seeing today, do you believe that the policies that were previously allowed by Bakke and Grutter played any role in agitating that, or perhaps militating what we would see without it?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure about the relationship between, you know, affirmative action and some of the pathologies, and I'm happy to say pathologies, that we find in our institutions of higher education. I'm not sure. I think it's worth, you know, studying. Maybe there is. I'm not sure. I do want to say a couple of things about higher education. because higher education has certainly, if you read the newspapers, there's a reason why higher education has been sinking in the esteem of the public. I'm very sorry about that. We need our institutions of higher education. We are absolutely dependent upon our institutions of higher education. I will say, I do think that some of the there's no doubt that there are aspects of collegiate and university life that warrant strong criticism. One always has to ask the question, though, you know, compared to what? So if we ask about what's going on at our campuses, the overall feel of our campuses, compared to 1960, compared to 1965, compared to 1970, compared to 1980, I would urge us to beware of a sort of nostalgia in which we think of the good old days. There are many ways in which our college campuses are much better than at any time in American history. You mentioned, for instance, my home university, Harvard University. And by the way, Harvard University, you know, because it's so well known, because it's so wealthy, gets dinged a lot. I have been at Harvard University now for nearly 40 years. I am very proud of my association with Harvard University. Harvard University is a great institution. And on the question of this last lawsuit, if one was to ask the question, for instance, about the status, the situation, for instance, of Asian Americans at Harvard University in the last 10 years as opposed to 20 years ago, as opposed to 30 years ago, Asian American students, people of Asian descent, much more comfortable, much more a part of Harvard University, and that could be said with a number of students from groups that have been historically marginalized. So I take what you're saying. I think that there is a problem with of pathologies at American universities, which you alluded to. Maybe there is a relationship between that and some of, you know, the affirmative action policies. But let us do keep perspective. I think that some of the talk about American universities has gone overboard, and that there has been too little attention paid to the strengths of American universities and the way in which, in some ways, they are much better than they have ever been. Thank you.
Professor Harriet, do you want to have any response? Or go to the...
I think we should go to
all right.
Questions.
Let's see what other people have to ask. Please, tell us your name and your question.
Charles Carell. West Point has already been sued. And Devin, I know you mentioned that that you thought it was a day pass. I was at a briefing with the head of admissions while the case was percolating up and asked the question, if the Harvard decision comes out as expected in the Supreme Court, and it applied to West Point, what would that do? And the admission officer candidly said there would be very few African Americans at West Point. So assuming that is true, how do you think the court will ultimately resolve the diversity issue as it applies to service academies?
Look, can you hear me? In my view, the analytical framework behind what the court did in the Harvard and UNC cases applies to the service academies. And quite frankly, I think it's even more important for the court to say, you know, once it has an opportunity to look at the service academies squarely, and again, I think it's just a day pass. It wasn't, you know, we're doing this carve out for service academies or anything like that. That it's even more important in the service academies and in the military not to allow racial discrimination. As a veteran myself, someone who served in Swift Boat Combat Squadron after 9/11, what you wanted in the military, right, was someone you could trust, right, going into battle with you, leading you into battle. And you, what we didn't want to do was to undermine that sort of thing with any concern that the person you were serving with in these very difficult situations was in any way less than the most qualified person for that. I think it's incredibly problematic, especially in a military context. And I expect the court to eventually say that. I think the only reason why they didn't say it, well, there are a number of reasons potentially why they didn't say it in the Harvard and UNC cases, but it wasn't before them.
We have a podcast episode on an hour and a half on just this issue, and you should listen to it, and I'm not so sure my friend is right. The rationale in the service academies is not a diversity-based rationale. It's more of a political proportionality rationale. The political rights are for, they go all the way back to the Reconstruction era, voting, voting on a jury or serving on a jury, voting in office or being voted for, and military service. In these four areas, there is more focus on bottom line proportionality having to do with political representativeness. Ronald Reagan says that his first appointment to the Supreme Court will be a woman, and it was a woman. Joe Biden says his replacement for Justice Breyer will be a black woman. So you do see more open emphasis on bottom line proportionality in the political rights domain. I mentioned jury service and voting. Military service is another one. So it's not the same rationale, and I don't know what the court will do. Randy did say one really interesting thing, which is that judges who are state actors openly take account, many of them, of demographic features in picking their law clerks and the like, and they're state actors. So there was a reason that those issues were bracketed. One of the really important influences in the Grutter case was the amicus brief by Colin Powell and other former military officers. So I'm not so sure that they will say it's exactly the same as Students for Fair Admission. We'll see.
Well, I would just like to add one thing, and that is that if I had been in charge of picking what case to go to next, I would not have picked the one that the Supreme Court dropped a footnote on and said, hey, this may be, you know, a different case. There is so much low-hanging fruit. I would have preferred to litigate something else.
I was just going to follow up to say that what the court is going to have to grapple with is the fact that very few of the officer corps actually come from the service academies. The vast majority of the officer corps come from regular colleges and universities where they've already outlawed racial preferences. And the great bulk of the remainder come from enlisted individuals who go on to the officer corps. So, I just point that out as something that the court has to grapple with.
Yes.
Next question.
Good point.
Good afternoon. Thank you, guys. My name is Ryan Keene, and this question is sort of directed at Professor Kennedy, but, you know, anyone's free to answer it. Professor Kennedy, it seemed like your argument for the benefits of racial consciousness distilled down to either the remedial effects that race consciousness will have or the benefits of diversity. My question is, and I think that this was really the thrust of a lot of the argument that happened in SFFA, is at what point do we reach the promised land? If we need to use remediation, if we need to recognize the benefits of diversity, at what point can we say to ourselves, honestly, we have now reached a point where we have achieved those goals? Because I think one of the troubling parts of the argument on the other side was they had no answer to that question. And it seems like a blank check that isn't really based on those justifications when there is no endpoint. And Grutter established an endpoint, so I do think that, you know, it wasn't necessarily way beyond judicial restraint. So that's my question.
Yeah. It's a great question, because I think that one of the things that bedevils us is an uncertainty, actually, about what we're trying to achieve. At certain points in American life, we've had metaphors that people have embraced. at this point, we don't really know what we want. On in April 1968, the great Martin Luther King Jr. said that he had been to the mountaintop and had glimpsed the promised land. And he said to his audience, mainly black audience, "I might not get there with you, but I've glimpsed the promised land." Unfortunately, he didn't tell us very much about the topography of the promised land. You know, what does it look like? And that's your question. You know, what does it look like? How do people act there? And I think we're struggling with that. So, for instance, one thing that some people say is, it's a very popular thing to say now, is, you know, we want a campus, we want a faculty, we want things to look like America. That's a metaphor one often hears, looks like America. In certain ways, that's attractive. On the other hand, again, to get back to the Supreme Court case, if you are an Asian American, you know, look like America, if you're part of a racial group that has 10% or 15%, well, okay, you know, your group shows up, 10 or 15%. What happens if you're 1%? Then it's very easy for you to be completely overlooked. Or to flip it around, just to give one more, you know, people talk about look like America. Well, you know, I'm a basketball fan. When I turn on the television and watch the NBA All-Star game, a team doesn't look like America. Is that a problem? You know, I think, well, this is a great team. But if looks like America is your baseline idea, we have a problem. I think we're in various ways reaching to try to figure out an answer to your very good question.
Two quick thoughts on endpoint. And this is the dishonesty of the discourse that we've had. Diversity is forward-looking, and we all benefit from it, and then we should do it forever and expand it and expand it and expand it. And Grutter says diversity, but then it actually says 25 years. That's backward-looking. If it's a remedy, then at a certain point, you know, the remedy ends. And so you see actually the tension, mm-hmm. you know, in Grutter itself, saying diversity, but also having a remedial idea of an endpoint. Second, in terms just of our national narratives and the way in which we are still broken and divided, white America tells itself that this is the promised land. And black America has historically said this is the land of Egypt, the land of bondage. You know, Martin King was the Moses of his people. And when he says, you know, hours before his death that he's seen the promised land, it's very prophetic. And that's why Taylor Branch writes these books, you know, Parting the Waters at Canaan's Edge, Pillar of Fire, that see black America as kind of an Egypt from which deliverance is sought. That's very different than the white American vision. We don't yet have, actually, an integrated national narrative.
One of the interesting things I thought about the sort of endpoint issue is if you look back at Bakke, you look at Fisher, you look at Greta and Gratz, both sides of the debate on the court seem to acknowledge there was some need for there has to be an endpoint. The dissents in the Harvard case don't seem to acknowledge that. And I thought that was very disturbing about the opinion.
I just wanted to comment to say that, you know, a lot of the discourse around affirmative action, race preferences, and so forth is this idea of a, you know, sort of a black vision or a white vision. Everything's very black and white, but one of the things that I'm hopeful about after the decision in June is that we get away from this idea that America is just black and white, and that really is the tension that we have. I mean, America is beautifully and incredibly multiracial and multiethnic, and it's increasingly so. I'm a biracial black man, and my children are, white, black, Vietnamese. You know, this country is changing rapidly, and I think our discourse around this really needs to be updated. And the way in which we treat people as individuals is the right way forward. We should really be thinking about how we do that in a way. I mean, we can experiment, right? The only thing that the Supreme Court, you know, did was to say that, well, the Equal Protection Clause says X. That's it. You can't experiment on racial discrimination. You can't discriminate on the basis of race. You can experiment in many other ways if you think there's an issue in terms of diversity, socioeconomic diversity, to get racial minorities up to par academically and competitive with others through K through 12 experimentation, and in poor K through 12 schools, intergenerational poverty, family and community cohesion, which is a big thing to me. You can still experiment. You just cannot. Supreme Court said, racially discriminate. That's all.
Are you going here or there?
Oh, to the back.
Okay, sure. So, Ilya Soman, George Mason University. Can people hear me, or is there?
Yes.
They care. Great. So, formally, the SFFA case was just about racial preferences in higher education, but in a famous passage in the opinion, Chief Justice Roberts says ending racial discrimination means ending all of it. And if he's serious about that, it seems like that has implications for many other areas of government policy, some of which will be to the taste of conservatives, racial preferences, for instance, government contracting, but some of which conservatives may be less comfortable with, such as the very largest or most common form of racial discrimination by government that we have in our society is racial profiling in law enforcement, which affects huge numbers of people every day. And it seems like if we are serious about government being colorblind, we can't make an exception for those government agents who carry badges and guns and have the power to arrest people. So I wonder, my question to the panel is, in what other areas do you think this decision has implications for, should have implications for, and how far should we go in acting on them?
Ilya, if I could just give a shout out to a book that I once reviewed a while ago in the Harvard Law Review. The book is called Race, Crime, and the Law. It's written by Randy Kennedy. I think the title of the book review is Three Cheers for Professor Kennedy. It's an amazing book. I commend it to you all.
Yeah, that's the book that first made me aware of the significance of this issue when I read it when I was in law school.
Anyone else have any thoughts?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you guys very much. Well, this has been a great panel, and I think has been the hallmark of the Federalist Society. We've taken a tough issue. We've discussed it honestly and collegially, and I know I learned something today. So would you join me in thanking our panelists?